200 million years ago, give or take, we began developing the kinds of teeth it would take to eat our way to today. Looking back, way back, we ask, how did teeth help make us human?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,131st edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Cusco who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at MetroFarm.com. But whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Hello, Jason.
Hello.
Is our pre-flight check complete?
All systems are go.
Then let's take off. Folks, today we are flying back in time, way back in time, to see if we can catch a glimpse of how we became human beings. Some 200 million years ago, give or take, we began developing the kinds of teeth it would take to chew our way to today. That chewing began, we are told, by Professor Peter Unger, that when mammals developed molars that opened a whole new world of eating possibilities. So fasten your seatbelt as we fly way back in time to the beginnings of our journey from mammal to hominid to humans. And who better to fly with then? Peter Unger, Dr. Peter Unger, who is a University of Arkansas paleontologist and author of Evolution's Bite. Dr. Unger, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael.
Pleased to have you aboard. Paleoanthropologist. Does everybody ask you if you eat paleo?
Yeah, oftentimes they do. And to answer the question, no, I don't.
Good for you. And, of course, we'll probably drift into exactly what that meant or means today later on down the line. But, Dr. Unger, what was it about paleoanthropology that drew you as a person into the field?
You know, I must have been 5 years old when I made my first visit to the American Museum of Natural History in New York. I saw the dinosaurs there and just fell in love with paleontology.
That was it.
Yes,
the dinosaurs you're looking at. You know, I recall being a Boy Scout and, on a camp out high in the Montana Rockies. And way up there at the top of the mountains, of Rocky Mountains, we ran into a field of seashell fossils. Way up on the top of the mountains. And I guess that was something that certainly opened my mind to oh my goodness, it's a very interesting world when it gets right down to it. University of Arkansas Unger Lab. So you have your own lab there. You're the chair of the anthropology department, I believe.
Well, I have cycled off the chair of the anthropology department. I'm now the director of our environmental dynamics program.
Ah, what's that?
It's a program for all kinds of research. We've got 100 different faculty affiliated with it, research that's associated with interactions between humans and the environment. So it covers the deep time element that we're going to speak about today, all the way up to sustainability issues.
And you speak a lot about collaborations. So you collaborate not just with people on the University of Arkansas campus, but with like-minded scientists all over the world, right?
All over the world. I mean, I've conducted research. I'm involved with faculty members in China. I've been a visiting professor in Australia, in Finland, and in South Africa, and so on.
Do you think it's really important for scientists to cycle about as you do?
Oh, it's critical today because we've all become so specialized in our little niche that we can't see the big picture unless we're working with other people who have different elements to bring to the story.
And that cross-pollination really helps that process, does it not?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, okay. Goodness, you focused your effort on at the Unger Lab on early mammals, especially humans, but what other kind of critters?
Well, you know, we work on everything from tyrannosaurid dinosaurs to modern people.
Wow.
So, yeah, everything in between.
And there are still, there's quite a bit of fossil evidence of that period, is there not?
There's thousands of fossils representing the human family tree that we know of today.
And is there, do you have a way of cataloging them all so it kind of represents a timeline?
Absolutely. In my lab alone, I've got hundreds and hundreds of replicas of teeth, which is the most common fossil type that we have. And they're all sort of identified down to species, and they've got dates associated with them in most cases. So, yeah, we've got a big computer system to help us keep track of that.
And what is it about teeth that grabbed you? I mean, as a way of looking back.
Oh, teeth are key. They're everything. If you start to think about it, teeth are the hardest parts of the body. They're effectively ready-made fossils, 97% mineral. And so they survive the ages. They're the most common fossils we find. And in the case of some species, it's the only fossils we find. And what makes them especially exciting is that they're keys to diet. They're the only parts of the digestive system that come into direct contact with food that are actually preserved in the fossil record.
Wow. So it's kind of like, if you know how to look at them, a lot of information there. But how on earth do you look at them? You suggest that the real interesting thing started happening about 200 million years ago, but how does science look back 200 million years?
Well, that's a long story and a difficult question. There are all kinds of different lines of evidence that we can pull from teeth. We can look at the We can look at the sizes, the shapes, the structures, the chemistry, the wear of the teeth. We can look for evidence of food particles that adhere and are preserved on the teeth. There's all these different types of evidence. Mm-hmm. When you get back to 200 million years ago, most of it's going to be in the form of the shapes of the teeth. And we can trace over time the changing shapes of the teeth and how that relates to diet.
So in your laboratory, you use a couple of technologies that you list on your website. One is dental topography and the other is dental microwear. So talk a little bit about the topography and how you go about studying that topography. That's like a topographical map, right? Mountains and rivers and everything?
Exactly. When I was first hired at the University of Arkansas, I was charged with taking advantage of what was then a new research center called our Center for Advanced Spatial Technologies. And CAST, as it's called, specializes in GIS, Geographic Information Systems, which is basically a way of relating information that's sort of tagged by geography. One thing that GIS researchers do really well is plot landscapes, develop what are called digital elevation models. You may have seen them on the internet, these sort of
right.
3D models of landscapes.
Mm-hmm. It's like taking a topographical map and then pulling the little lines and pulling them up so that the mountains come up and the valleys go down, right?
Exactly. And so I started to think, how can I use this? And I realized, well, you know what? Teeth are basically landscapes, and we can model teeth like landscapes. The cusps on the teeth become mountains. The fissures in the teeth become valleys. And we can basically take 3D models of teeth and analyze them as if they were landscapes. So I have some fancy equipment. I've got laser scanners and touch probe scanners, and they give me 3D models of the surfaces of teeth, and I basically open them in the GIS software and analyze them. You can look at things like water flow patterns across teeth and so on to try and get a better sense of the structure in fine detail.
Wow. So you find a fossil of a tooth and you subject it to this a laser scan, put it into the software program, and you have a topography of a tooth. And you can look way, way back in that way. What about dental microwear? How does that fit in?
Well, that's, in a sense, it's similar. But instead of looking at the whole tooth surface, we look at a very small part of the surface, maybe a tenth of a millimeter by a tenth of a millimeter. And again, we look at it in three dimensions, and the pattern of wear on the tooth at these very, very high magnifications can tell us something about diet. So if it's really scratchy, for example, it tells us that the teeth were probably used for shearing for tough foods like meat or leaves. And if there are a lot of pits, it tells us that the teeth were probably used for pounding or crushing hard objects like nuts or bone.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Right back, we're going back 200 million years to find out how we became human beings by eating.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, seed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. You can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy. You can do it. Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy. You can do it. Metro Farm it. And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, how did we chew our way through 200 million years of life on Earth to become the human beings of today? Good question. Who better to ask than Dr. Peter Unger of the Unger Lab of the University of Arkansas, paleoanthropologist. That's a mouthful right there. You know, you talk about being able to take a fossilized tooth, subject it to a laser scan, measure or develop a topography of that tooth, and then zero in on a little tiny parcel of that map, and then figure out what that critter ate way back then. But it seems to me like you would need a little bit of more information to complete the picture and to employ your imagination. What else must you know, Dr. Unger?
In terms of...
You must need to know what kind of food was around back then.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. What we do is we go back and we look at the other animals and evidence of the plants that were present at the time in that place. And we essentially try and reconstruct what the animals that we're interested in chose from among the different foods available at a given time and at a given place. So I like to think of the biosphere, that part of our planet which harbors life, as a kind of giant buffet of sorts, right? So all the animals belly up to the sneeze guard with their plates in their hands, and they pick and choose from whatever items are available. We have to know what items are available, and we can use teeth to at least get a sense of the choices that they make.
Ah, so you have you kind of have an idea of what was available way back then, and you have fossilized evidence of which foods they selected. So take us back 200 million years to that time when somehow we evolved a set of choppers that helped us chew our way to today. What was the first big step in that process?
Well, if we go back about 250 million years or so, I would say that our ancestors had pointed teeth, cone-like teeth, not unlike what you think of in terms of reptiles and fish today. They're basically sharp little spikes or cones. And then what was really interesting is through some sort of an evolutionary event, there were tiny little bumps that grew right in front and back of those original cone-like teeth, and those eventually evolved into the kinds of teeth that we have today. And in fact, we can trace the evolution from cones to sort of the squarish molars that we have over time. There was a key event that happened about 150 million years ago called the tribosphenic molar. That's a mouthful, but basically what it is it's the first tooth that was capable of doing both shearing or slicing and crushing or grinding. And it was from that basic tooth type, the tribosphenic molar, that all of the myriad forms of molars we have today evolved.
And, you guys employ a whole bunch of imagination here. I know you must. What do you imagine, Davis, gave cause to the bumps on our teeth?
Just a genetic mutation that was beneficial that was carried on from generation to generation. That's the stuff of evolution.
Okay. So a gift, and away we go. It changed the nature of our diet, did it not? We went from being rippers and slashers into being chompers and grinders and chewers.
We see in a lot of different lineages of animals, we see mammals begin sort of as meat eaters, and they evolve to take advantage of plants after that. Some, of course, retain the ability to eat meat and continue to eat meat, but the early mammals were able to eat an increasingly broad range of foods, in part because they had the utensils, the teeth necessary to process those foods.
So a new set of tools that opened up the smorgasbord of life, as it were, to all kinds of new possibilities of things to eat.
That's right. They were able to take advantage, as I would say, of more of the dishes that were available in that giant buffet.
And looking back, you have a lot of fossilized plant fossils, too, right? So you can get an idea of what perhaps they were eating?
That's part of it. Most of what we don't have, oftentimes we don't have a lot of fossilized plants, but what we do have is the chemistry of the soil, which can tell us something about the temperature and the humidity, and from that, and the kinds of photosynthesis that the plants that lived on that soil were doing, from all that information we can sort of reconstruct roughly whether we were looking at a savanna or a forest or a woodland, and so on.
I can see that. So where do you get the information about the soil chemistry?
Well, basically, you dig the fossilized soils, these old soils, out of the ground. They're eroding out, and you take the samples of the soil, and you bring them to the lab, and you basically look at the isotopes. Use an instrument called a mass spectrometer, and off you go.
Mm-hmm. Now, what would be the difference, then, between a jungle soil, the chemistry of a jungle soil, and the chemistry of a savanna soil?
Well, in the tropics, grasses have a different way of doing photosynthesis than trees. And because of that, the grasses, you know, there's carbon, for example, has different forms that it comes in called different isotopes. And the ratios, the different types of isotopes that you see resulting from grasses are different from the isotopes that result from forests. So that you can basically look at the carbon in these old fossil soils and tell whether it was a forest or a grassland way back when.
And there is a big difference between the jungle and the grasslands, right?
Absolutely.
So at one time we lived in the jungle and perhaps were a bit like the hominids that still live in the jungle, but we somehow made a transition, right?
Well, the current theory is that Africa about 10 million years ago began to split in half, right? And today we see it still splitting along what's called the Great Rift Valley that runs all the way down Africa, splitting it in an eastern part and a western part. And when that happened, what had been before woodlands across the continent on the east side turned into savanna, and on the west side turned into rainforest. And our common ancestors with chimpanzees were woodland creatures. But after Africa began to split, the chimpanzee, or our common ancestors that evolved into chimpanzees, became rainforest creatures. And those that evolved into us, well, as the savannas began to spread, we were forced out of the trees.
Wow. And some would say we're still out of our trees.
I suppose.
So that would be the Great Rift, would be representative of the Great Rift of the species and the Great Dividing of the species.
Yes, very much so.
Okay. Wow. Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're looking back a couple hundred year, million years, and kind of following the timeline up to today in relation to how we chew our way through the history of life here on Earth, and what gave us gave rise, I guess, to the human beings and separated us from the animal kingdom. Was essentially how we adapted to our environment. And so when we get back with us, we're going to pick that up with Dr. Peter Unger, who is the University of Arkansas's paleoanthropologist and also the author of Evolution's Bite, a look at how teeth gave rise to the human beings and separated us from the animal kingdom. If you have a question you'd like to put on the table, we'd love to hear it. We are at 831-479-1080, 831-479-1080. Pick up your phone and join us.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you know how to combine white light confocal profilometry with scale-sensitive fractal analysis, you can look back a couple hundred million years, see what people were eating, and how what they ate helped them become different kinds of people, different kinds of critters, and eventually how they became human beings. I guess the big leap occurred when we climbed out of the trees and walked out into the grasslands. Is that true, Dr. Unger?
Well, that's a bit of a simplification, but essentially, yeah, when the environments started to change dramatically during the time period we call the Pleistocene, from about 5 million years onward, that's when we start to see the major changes, the increase in brain size, the commitment to the ground. And
what do you mean, the commitment to the ground?
Well, in terms of coming down out of the trees,
okay, gotcha,
and abandoning them and the technology that followed.
Well, help us through that transition. When we're living in the trees, you know, swinging from branches to branches, I guess we were living up there because we felt a little more protected.
Well, we were a little bit more protected. You had 10 large-bodied species of carnivore on the ground at that time, lions and leopards and cheetahs and hyenas and things of that nature. And so being able to escape to the trees was an important way for our ancestors to be able to survive.
And then when we climbed out of the trees, did those large carnivores, like, disappear? Or
no, we just became better at avoiding them or fending them off.
Do you think that had a lot to do with the expansion of our brain size then? Figuring out how to not get eaten?
Expanding brain size certainly played a role in it, because it allowed us, and of course this is all theoretical, but it seems to have allowed us to develop more complex social organizations and coordinate defense. It allowed us to develop the technology necessary to fend off these large carnivores. We're not particularly powerful animals. We don't have big, sharp canine teeth. And so we had to ultimately adopt probably wooden spears and so forth. We know that we had stone tools and things of that nature in order to protect ourselves.
I featured a paleoanthropologist some time ago who talked about the relationship of man and dogs back in that time and suggested that our ability to domesticate dogs was also a big help in surviving in those times.
Yeah, well, it really depends who you ask.
Of course.
There's a couple of different theories out there. One theory is that we, as a species, domesticated dogs 30, 40, 50,000 years ago in Europe, and that helped us hunt the large game during the Ice Age and, in fact, outcompete the Neanderthals. And another body of theory suggests that maybe dogs became domesticated when we settled down and started to grow crops. And they just sort of, the wolves sort of came in and ate our garbage and, mm-hmm. and became domesticated that way. So I think it's still pretty much up in the air.
And probably will be for a while, I would suspect. What about then when we climbed down out of the trees and walked out into the grasslands? What did we start eating? How did our diets change? And well, how did having those chompers help?
Well, essentially, what I will say, I'll preface this by saying we no longer have what's called the savanna hypothesis, where there was just this massive change when the forest disappeared and the savanna spread. It seems to have been more like increasing variability in the environment. In other words, there were swings back and forth from woodland and forest to grassland, and then back to woodland, and then back to grassland. And those swings became increasingly intense over time. And the current theory is that, in fact, we evolved for versatility, for the ability to handle these massive environmental changes. And that's where sort of our brain size and our new toolkit and our broadening diet really came in. So when the savannas began to spread, it seems as if we see evidence of meat eating. We see evidence of possibly taking underground roots and tubers, storage organs, things of that nature, and incorporating those into the diet. But we never really lost our ability to eat forest fruits when we could get them.
So it would seem like it's almost like a climate change theory of evolution.
That's exactly what it is, and that's really what drives evolution.
You mean we had climate change before today?
We sure did. It's been getting progressively cooler and drier over the last basically 65 million years. And in addition, the degree of change in terms of becoming more and more intense, the amplitude of the climate change has been increasing over the past 5 million years. And a lot of people feel that that's what triggered human evolution. I'm not denying anthropogenic climate change. I very much believe in it. We're having a major influence on it today. But climate change is not new, and it's absolutely perfectly natural as well.
Mm-hmm. And the emerging theory is that we adapted, we became the critter best able to cope with all of this change.
Absolutely. And in fact, when we look at the human fossil record, it's really interesting because there were several experiments. Some of our cousins, our near cousins, were extreme specialists on the open savanna with adaptations for crushing things like roots and tubers and seeds. And others seemed to become more generalized. Their teeth became wimpier. They started to use tools. Their brains grew larger. They were more flexible and versatile. The ones that were specialists eventually died out, because the environmental change was just probably too much for them to handle. But our ancestors, who were able to deal with this broad, changing environment and the unpredictable conditions, were the ones that won the day.
You say cousins. Would you describe them?
Sure.
What kind of cousins did we have?
There's a group that we call Paranthropus, which in Latin means near human. And they lived from about 2.5 million years ago to about 1.5 million years ago. And we share a common ancestor with them. About 3 million years ago, there was this split between them and our own ancestors. And so they're on the human family tree. They came well after our split with the chimpanzees, but they're not exactly us. They're like near cousins.
And because they were not able to adapt, they died.
Because they didn't have the versatility to handle these ever-changing conditions. And nature continually swapping the items on this biospheric buffet that I keep referring to, they weren't able to deal with it.
One kind of food today, another kind of food tomorrow. If you couldn't eat both kinds of food, you're going to be in trouble.
Exactly.
Well, okay, immensely fascinating. Look at how we, and all of this, of course, can be found in Evolution's Bites. Is that true?
Most of it for sure.
Most of it for sure. which is the new book just out by Dr. Peter Unger from the paleoanthropologist from University of Arkansas and the director of the Unger Lab, where they look way back in time using fossils and other sources of information to see how we were and how we changed to become who we are today. And it seems like the ability to adapt to change is the key to survival for just about everything. And that's how, I guess that's what we're probably best at. Is it not true, Doctor?
Yeah, well, that's probably why we've got the big brains that we've got today, our ability to cope with unpredictable situations.
How then did the cockroach survive? Well, we'll pick that up when we get back. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson. Do stay tuned, 831-479-1080, if you'd like to go back in time with us. Pick up the phone and join us.
History Buffs. This tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the USS Dale at Guam, 15 August, 1945.
When word came through that the war had ended, everyone went wild. We made noise with whatever we could get our hands on. Sirens shrieked, bells rang, horns bellowed, sailors whooped and hollered. I was the wildest of all because when I first went in the Navy, I read you had to do everything you could to keep your head and nerves together so you could survive to the end. Well, I held myself together almost 4 years aboard that tin can, and I made it through to the end. Yes, I celebrated. I whooped and I hollered and I banged on metal. You bet I did. And I celebrated a bunch for all those guys that couldn't, too.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. Talesfromatincan.com.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, the proposition put forth by Dr. Peter Unger in Evolution's Bite is that when we picked up teeth through the gift of evolution that allowed us to rip and tear and chomp and grind, it gave us the ability to adapt to all kinds of different changes that nature provided in our diet. And thus, we are really grew into what we've become today, human beings, from what we were back then. What were we back then, Dr. Unger?
We were pretty much animals, just like any other animal on the planet. And I guess it depends upon when you're talking about, when you say back when, because we've always been a work in progress.
And we still are a work in progress, I assume. But let me ask you this. There are some critters about that don't seem to have changed at all, that are very specialized, and I think of like pelicans.
I don't know much about pelicans. Certainly they've been on the planet for some time, but I can't tell you exactly how long. Certainly I would say that the birds, the initial birds that survived the great asteroid or comet that hit the planet that killed off the dinosaurs, those were certainly water birds. But I don't know much about pelicans per se.
Okay. What about cockroaches? Would they be among the adaptables, like people?
Cockroaches are pretty tolerant to different environmental conditions. And anybody who lives say in New York City or another place where cockroaches are endemic and ubiquitous knows that it's really difficult to kill them. So
they are.
Say that they're able to tolerate a broad variety of environments.
Okay, take that, New Yorkers. Paleo diet, of course, you know, I'm sure everybody, as a paleo anthropologist, everybody asks you if you're eat the paleo diet. But what exactly does that mean, the paleo diet?
Well, a paleo diet is a very specific diet. I prefer to talk about the Paleolithic diets, because this is sort of the broad general category of diets. There are lots of them. There's Neanderthin, and there's the paleo diet, and there's the ancestral diet, and it's these. This is just sort of a genre of many different types of diets. Basically, the argument is that just as you wouldn't put diesel in a car built for regular gasoline, you shouldn't eat foods that we haven't evolved or been designed to eat.
And but that would go kind of contrary to what your theory is, right? I mean,
exactly.
It seems like we evolved to eat everything, or just about.
That is the exact point, the exact point. And in fact, according to the proponents of the paleo diet, if we don't eat what we're designed to eat, you're going to run into all kinds of trouble. So whether you're filling your tank or stuffing your face, the wrong foods can wreak havoc on a system. And as a result, we get all these chronic degenerative diseases. We get heart disease. We get diabetes. We get cancer, and on and on and on. And, I mean, there certainly is a point. There are certain foods that are causing us trouble, and I would never deny that. But what... trying to plan a menu based on our ancestral diet is kind of foolhardy, because there is no single ancestral diet. As I said before, we're a work in progress, and our diets change dramatically over time. And the fact that we do eat fried cakes and drink cola and so forth, that's all because we can. That's all because our ancestors prepared us for a very broad-based diet.
And we certainly have, you know, compared to one of the fun things you talked about. What did the paleo folks eat way back then in Paleolithic times? Probably a handful of acorns and a lizard if they could catch one.
They ate pretty much anything they could get hold of. So the whole idea that we need to be consuming grass-fed cow meat or fish, and we need to get our carbohydrates from non-starchy vegetables and fresh fruits, that doesn't hurt. There's no question that those are good things to eat. But I'm not really sure that they're based on our understanding of what our ancestors ate.
Probably based on what we think our ancestors might have eaten had they had the selection, the ability to select what they would like to eat. Something like that, right?
Truth? If our ancestors had the ability to select what they wanted to eat, I would bet you they would be eating fudge and potato chips.
Hostess Twinkies, I'm sure.
Well, certainly.
Okay, so we have adapted to change, and that's what really made us what we are. Gave us, we started with our teeth, and it went right to our brains, and our brains become big, and we can now adapt to many different things. How is that evolution coming?
How's that evolution coming?
Yeah, I mean, we have to take a break here in a minute, but it seems to me you talked about how earlier you talked about how the environment or climate change is really changing now. The amplitude of change is speeding up and growing in dimensions. And it seems to me like there are so many other things that are changing as well. You know, the things that might cause a little click in our evolution, some of the things we eat, the electromagnetic fields we walk through, those kinds of things. Do you think evolution is slowing down or speeding up? I guess that's what the question I wanted to ask. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. Couple minutes left with Dr. Peter Unger. Boy, it would be fun to sit in on one of your classes. and just let the mind drift back a couple hundred million years, speculate and on how we became the people that we are today. 831-479-1080 is the phone number. Pick up your phone and join us. We will be right back with Dr. Peter Unger.
Here's a little secret I'm telling you. Take a little pledge called the 2x2. Spend $2 on local food each day and get two friends, do the same and play. Oh, they'll spend their money, and when they're through, they'll get two friends and do it too.
We can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom. It won't cost an extra dime, and it will be so easy, it will make you blush. All it takes is two numbers. One is two, the other is 2-2. Join us. Take the 2x2 pledge.
There's a little secret I shared with you, a simple pledge called the 2x2. You can do it. It don't cost much. It's so easy, it'll make you blush. Pledge two local bucks each day. Get two others to pledge and play.
Take your 2x2 pledge at MetroFarm.com.
2x2. So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
And oh boy, we have one of the great university professors of paleoanthropology here. We're in class. We can raise our hand and ask any question we want. So I have two. The first one being Dr. Unger. Dr. Unger, what is evolution like now? Is it speeding up? Is it slowing down? Will our bodies be able to adapt? What do you think?
Well, the great thing about evolution is it doesn't stop. We have always evolved and will continue to evolve. But the other great thing about evolution is that it's entirely random. And we can't predict what's going to happen in the future and what it's going to look like.
And do you see evidence of evolution, of the amplitude of evolution speeding up or slowing down? You mentioned lactose intolerance, for example.
Absolutely. And in fact, we know that we're continuing to evolve because of things like our ability to digest milk sugar into adulthood. Why on earth would we evolve the ability to digest milk as adults, especially milk of other animals? It just doesn't make evolutionary sense. And in fact, people that don't have a pastoralist ancestry, people who don't have ancestors that raised animals for milk, don't have the ability to digest milk sugar. And the same goes actually for our ability to process gluten. There's something called amylase. There's a gene that's capable of that provides us the enzymes we need to break down starches, and we have an increased number of these genes. Those of us that have ancestry that has farming in it and gluten, and that is another example, like the ability to break down milk sugar. And these things have all come in the last 10,000 years.
So relatively recently.
Very recently, from an evolutionary perspective.
Well, my final question is, you'll probably think me crazy for asking it, but since I'm a student in your class today, I'm going to ask it anyway. Professor, do you think God created Adam and Eve, or did they just show up?
Whoa. That's a really tough question. And one, since I'm gonna plead the fifth on that, since I teach at a public university and I'm not supposed to talk about creation versus evolution, I have plenty of colleagues who believe that evolution was God's way of creating people, but plenty of other colleagues that argue that there's not a need to invoke God to do that. I'm not going to express my own opinion on that one, though.
Oh, shucks. But, so it's not a crazy question, then, is it?
Oh, no, it's a very relevant question, especially in my part of the country.
Good. Well, folks, this has been the Food Chain Radio Program. What fun. So really, it was the developing, it all started when we developed these bumps on our teeth that allowed us to chew things over. And so when we got booted out of the jungle, we were able to chew things over throughout time until we ended up today. So if you'd like to consider that story, I suggest you pick up a copy of Evolution's Bite and let your mind wander with science as a guide back a couple hundred years and follow it up to today and maybe get a better idea of who we are. Dr. Unger, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you. It's been fun.
Right.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.